Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, 202 southbound the Red Mountain Freeway, the exit ramp at McKellops is blocked. Elsewhere, collisions US 60 eastbound at McClintock, I-17 southbound at Camelback, and in the far West Valley, I-10 westbound at Tonopah. It'll be sunny for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 98 degrees, right around average for today. It's 96 right now at KJZZ. Arizona Public Service customers are about to get a glimpse of what their new electricity rates could be next year. KJZZ's Will Stone reports the utility will be filing its rate case with state regulators tomorrow.
APS hasn't even revealed its specific proposal, how customers' bills will change and by how much. But already comments are building up, mostly centered on the billing mechanism APS is expected to use, called a demand charge. That's tied to the hour during peak demand, when a customer uses the most power. The utility has argued that such a charge better reflects the cost they incur, especially during summer months when power needs are greatest. But critics argue it's anti-consumer and too complicated for the typical residential customer. This rate case comes amid the ongoing fight between the rooftop solar industry and utilities, which contend the current rate structure for solar is unsustainable. It's anticipated APS will propose changes that could shape the future of that renewable energy source in Arizona. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The judge in the racial profiling case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is getting details today about potential remedies in the case. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is at the federal courthouse in Phoenix. And Jude, what's the mood like over there?
Well, it is actually sort of like a carnival atmosphere outside. There is a giant inflatable likeness of Arpaio that's sort of floating around. Looks like he's wearing stripes in the suggestion of a prison uniform. And they're singing and chanting outside, a lot of signs, protesters calling for Arpaio to face criminal charges. So that's what's going out outside, and we can actually even hear the echo of the chants inside the courthouse as well. Not in the courtroom, but in the courthouse itself.
Jude, heading into this hearing, one of the big issues was how to compensate the people who were wrongfully detained when the sheriff's office violated the judge's orders. Have there been any clues so far as to how that will work?
Yeah, so the parties have basically agreed that there will be some kind of compensation program for people who were wrongfully detained and to get money. And the judge has set that minimum amount at about $1,500 minimum for each person who can prove that that was the case for them. One of the big questions, though, is who is responsible to fund this program? And we heard from the county's lawyer, the lawyer representing Maricopa County's interests, separate from the sheriff's office, trying to make the case that the county should not be liable for intentional, willful violations of the court order by the sheriff's office. The judge did not seem to really buy that argument and suggested that the county probably would be responsible, but indicated he also knew that it would be very expensive. The plaintiffs have indicated they would like to see the sheriff personally pay $300,000 out of pocket to get this fund going, and also to do the outreach and noticing all of the advertising that this compensation plan will involve. The judge had questions for them. Under what authority can I ask the sheriff to personally pay $300,000 towards this? So that remains a big question, is sort of where will this money come from? What will it mean for taxpayers? And what will it mean for the people who were wrong?
Lots of questions, Jude, but obviously the big question on everyone's minds is, will this end with criminal prosecution? Has there been any discussion of that aspect so far?
Not so far. I mean, I think that the judge has wanted to focus this hearing on the civil remedies, and really the idea is if the civil remedies aren't enough, at that point he would refer to criminal. We did get a small clue in the sense that he did indicate that he did not plan to refer Lieutenant Sousa for criminal, and he also mentioned again that he had not found one chief, Jack McIntyre, in contempt, and he actually excused him. That still leaves three contemnors as a possibility to face criminal charges, and we don't know yet if that will be the judge's recommendation. The hearing is still ongoing, so we will see.
Jude, what's next?
Well, there's been a long conversation about changes to the Internal Affairs Division, how much responsibility should be given to an independent authority to make sure that officer misconduct is adequately investigated and disciplined. The judge has made clear that his goal is to rehabilitate the sheriff's office, and he wants whatever devices he uses to be temporary, so that basically after a few years, the sheriff's office can do these investigations adequately on their own. So we're still waiting to see what the actual details will look like, but we know a big piece of this remedy will involve changing the Internal Affairs Division.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block at the Federal Courthouse in downtown Phoenix. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
Tucson officials are trying to fill some of the empty and rented houses near the University of Arizona campus. They're trying to reach out to university employees as potential buyers. Tucson Mayor Jonathan Rothschild joins me with more on this. And Mayor Rothschild, why are there so many empty homes around the U of A campus?
Well, it's not just empty homes, but also a lot of rentals. And this is something that has been common in university communities around the country. In fact, our Drachman Institute down here in Tucson did a study back all the way in the year 2000 and found that there was this high level of rentals and vacancies around the university. So, unfortunately, that study sat on a shelf. The study was done again in 2010, of course, after the 2007-2008 financial collapse, and the numbers were worse. And they did this study again in 2015, and surprisingly to me, because we're seeing a recovery, the numbers were still worse. So at that point, I thought we ought to take action.
Well, so what do you do about that?
What we've done is put together our Tucson Association of Realtors and some of the finance companies and our home builders and brought them all together, and we've crafted a program that we're going to really get out there in the next 30 days or so. But it has a lot to do with educating people, counseling people, and making opportunities available to them.
Why is it important to have homes around the university to have owners as opposed to them? Obviously, it's not great to have them empty, but why would you prefer to have them owned as opposed to have them rented out by, say, students?
Right. Well, one of the things that's happened here, too, and why we're seeing some more vacancies, is we've built some student towers that are fairly significant, and the neighbors wanted that. They, you know, the people who live in the neighborhood like the students to be closer to campus, but then what happened was these homes then began to sit empty. In home ownership, not just around the university area, but anywhere, any neighborhood, brings great benefit in that people, when they own the homes, take pride of ownership. So the homes are, and the neighborhoods are generally better kept, and those homes certainly tend to be, not in every case, but tend to be. And when you live in the neighborhood, you have a motivation to get to know your neighbors. So that helps with safety. It helps with community pride. We're also trying to attract, in some of these cases, younger families back into the neighborhoods, which then also creates a sense of community.
What is the market like for some of these homes? I mean, are these places that university employees could afford to buy?
Oh, absolutely. And here in Tucson, it's still a market that is affordable. These are homes that can go anywhere from $150,000, probably up to $350,000, but there's a whole lot in that $150,000 to $200,000 range.
Would it be your preference that the homes around the university be filled by people who are affiliated with the university as opposed to just regular Tucson residents?
Well, I don't have any preference. I want to really build up the home ownership. But I can tell you at the university, and I've spoken with the university president, and she's endorsed this program, they would like to see their employees around the university. You know, we now have a modern streetcar, so it makes parking much more easy. It makes it so that people can walk to work or bike to work. And it creates that sense of university community. And those communities where you see that that's occurred, it brings a real strength to a city.
Tucson Mayor Jonathan Rothschild. Mayor Rothschild, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5 for Tuesday, May 31st. Along with the Takeaways' John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. A nice day at the zoo at the beginning of the Memorial Day weekend became a moment of terror when a 400-pound gorilla found a 4-year-old boy in the Cincinnati Zoo's primate exhibit. The boy had climbed over a barrier and fallen into the exhibit. When the crowd saw the gorilla dragging the boy around, it went wild. Zoo officials shot and killed the gorilla with a high-powered rifle. Video of the death of Harambe the gorilla was posted online. Thousands responded to a petition to stop zoos altogether. Thane Maynard is the director of the Cincinnati Zoo.
The people that say that, A, don't understand primate biology and silverback gorillas and the danger the child was in, and B, we're not there at an important time to make important decisions.
Tim Zimmerman is a contributing editor for Outside Magazine, a critic of zoos, who says that this incident raises an old issue for zoos and animal preservation.
I mean, the truth is that Western lowland gorillas, of which Harambe is, you know, are a non-aggressive, quite peaceful species. They're not territorial. The main reason for aggression among those sorts of gorillas is a male competitor coming close to some females. So I agree that I don't think that, you know, anyone expert who has looked at the video has seen overt aggression in the gorilla. I think what the zoo was struggling with was the possibility that the crowds and the situation would agitate the gorilla, and either accidentally or because he got so stressed, the child might have been seriously injured. But, you know, I'd like to know more about the, you know, the history of that particular gorilla. And I wish animal care staff, who would obviously know him best of all, had been more directly involved in making a decision about whether he should be shot or not.
And this does raise the question, as you've raised a moment ago, that, you know, what is the plan B here? I mean, what do they have a clearly worked out plan for something like this, or do they just assume the design will prevent anyone from getting into the caged area or the walled off area? It seems as though they just had no plan.
From the zoo's perspective, that design, the zoo has said, had worked for 38 years. So it's obvious that over time, eventually it didn't work, and they'll obviously revisit it. But I think that the more important point is, no matter what the design, no matter what the plan, when animals are in zoos, bad things can happen. I mean, there was an incident in Argentina just a little while ago where a person entered a lion enclosure and the two lions had to be shot. So when you mix people and animals together in these captive settings, I think it's impossible to prevent any and all types of incidents and problems. And that also, it's important just to say that even when things are going right at zoos, the lives of gorillas, for example, at zoos are not very great lives. I mean, gorillas exhibit many types of stereotypical behaviors which show boredom or stress. They don't like to be looked at, which is obviously why they're there in the zoo. And surveys have indicated that perhaps half of all zoos that keep gorillas give them psychotropic drugs to mood stabilize them. So I think that's really an important message to get out to people, is that the lives in general, regardless of whether there's children accessing an environment, of these animals is a pretty difficult compromised life. And the zoos justify it mainly by saying that they're helping conserve the species. But if you measure their success against the trajectory of all these species that they're allegedly helping promote conservation of, you'd have to say that they're utterly failing in that mission. And so that does really raise a big question about whether zoos can be justified anymore.
You've got two mobs here also. You've got the mob at the zoo freaking out over the kid inside the cage, agitating the gorilla. And presumably the zoo made a decision based, as you're saying, on that crowd. But then you've got another mob on the internet saying, oh, the poor gorilla. I mean, how does that shift so quickly? And are they different people talking?
Well, I think it's very different people talking. I mean, once the child's in the enclosure, you've got a real problem. And probably from the zoo's point of view, you know, I mean, just to be completely blunt about it, the downside of shooting their gorilla, who's one of nine, and that zoo is a very prolific breeder of gorillas, is you have a dead gorilla. The downside of a child being killed is probably, to most of the world, a bigger tragedy and probably a massive lawsuit. And so you can see where the zoo ended up making the decision they made. I do think that if the child had been injured or killed, we'd be having a different conversation. So I do have some sympathy for the quandary the zoo was in. I don't have as much sympathy for just the fact that, you know, the zoos inevitably put people and animals in this sort of position at some point or another.
Is the gorilla an endangered species?
that gorilla is a critically endangered species, and that particular gorilla that they shot is part of a quote-unquote species survival plan, which is mainly a breeding plan to promote and propagate the species. But the reality of zoo breeding programs tends to be that they're breeding gorillas and animals to populate zoos. For example, in the United States, there's never been a single elephant that has ever gone back into the wild. And these gorillas that the Cincinnati Zoo is so good at breeding are going to other zoos. They're not going to the western lowlands of Africa to repopulate the species there. So what they're talking about is basically preserving a species in captivity. And if that's our measure of success, then I'd say we're failing terribly, because the important thing is to try to conserve the environment in which the gorillas exist in Africa. And I just don't think zoos are really conveying the message bluntly enough to their visitors, what visitors need to do and the ways in which they need to think about their lifestyle that affects these gorillas in the wild.
Tim Zimmerman is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. What would happen in Phoenix if there was a similar incident to the one in Cincinnati? To answer that, I'm joined by Denise Wagner. She's senior keeper of primates at the Phoenix Zoo. And Denise, does the Phoenix Zoo have an emergency plan in place for this kind of situation?
Yes, we absolutely do. We do have an emergency response team. It's called our Dangerous Animal Response Team. And we run drills yearly, three or four drills a year. We do a lot of drills just practicing loading weapons. We also do a lot of drills that doesn't even involve weapons. It's just for animals that, you know, are not considered a dangerous animal but may get out. As an AZA-accredited zoo, and AZA is Association of Zoos and Aquariums, part of our accreditation process is making sure that we have those mechanisms in place.
What is the decision-making process like, going from, okay, maybe we can rescue somebody without having to do anything, maybe we can just use a tranquilizer, or we actually have to shoot and kill an animal?
That's actually a very long, involved process, but it can go very quickly because it depends on the situation. What we do is when we get to a scene of, if we get to a scene of an emergency, we evaluate what the situation is, and there's usually senior staff on hand that will, you know, make those decisions. Can an, you know, an animal be tranquilized safely? Can a person be rescued? There's a whole series of things that go into this decision making, and there is no set way to determine it. It's all based on circumstances.
I would imagine at some point it's kind of a judgment call, right?
It is very much a judgment call, and we have to rely on our knowledge of the animal and the animal's behavior, as well as the situation that we find ourselves in. So yes, it is very much a judgment call, and it's never taken lightly, and it's never done easily.
Has the Phoenix Zoo ever had occasion to have to use this emergency plan?
No, we have never had to deploy a Code Red team. Code Red is our term for dangerous animal escape. So we work very hard to make sure that that does not happen, and we have a lot of safety protocols in place to prevent those sorts of things, as does any AZA-accredited zoo.
When the first response team is on a scene and trying to figure out what it's going to do, is it any more complicated than we need to do whatever we can to make sure that the person is safe?
Yes. Basically, what it boils down to is human life is always going to be placed above animal life, and I know that there are people who don't agree with that, but that is the way that we operate in the zoo world, is a person's life is extremely important, and we are going to put that person's life above an animal's life. What we would like, we'd like the outcome to be that both the guest and the animal in a similar situation would come out safely, but sometimes you have to make a choice in the moment that some people will call into question later and some people will consider a must.
Denise Wagner is senior keeper of primates at the Phoenix Zoo. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
A lot of the canals winding their way through the valley are not exactly what you would call friendly places.
Most people think of the Grand Canal as a place where you get water, but other than that, they sort of turn their backs on it. It's kind of become an eyesore.
Kerry Wilcoxon is the head of the Neighborhood Traffic Safety Group for the City of Phoenix and an engineer with the city.
You can see mattresses and shopping carts and a lot of refuse from the neighborhoods around it dumped along the side of it.
Bud Wilcoxon hopes all of that is going to change soon. He's helping to implement the city's Grand Canalscape plan, which will create a nearly 12-mile trail system along the Grand Canal from the I-17 to the Phoenix-Tempe border. And ultimately, the plan will create a continuous trail all the way from Glendale to Tempe. And the show's Lauren Gilger went out to the canal with Wilcoxon to find out more about what's coming. And Lauren, I know this plan's been in the works for quite some time. It sounds like they're finally going to get this underway.
They are. They're working on it. The city is holding a public meeting next month to update people on the design plans, get some public feedback, and lay out their timeline for the project. So they're set to begin construction on phase one of the project next spring, which covers the canal from about 15th Avenue to 16th Street in Uptown Phoenix. And then by next winter, they say they'll start construction on the rest of it on the west end and the east end of it.
And how did all this get started?
Well, like you said, the idea of reinventing the canals in the valley has been around for a really long time. Then, a few years ago, Arizona Forward, a business-based environmental public interest group here, started working with four schools built around the canal in Central Phoenix, Central High School, Xavier, Brophy College Prep, and St. Francis. And with the help of some of their students, they came up with a plan to revitalize the canal that separates their campuses. The city liked the idea. They tracked down some funding, and eventually, this larger plan to revitalize much more of the canal was born. I also talked to the president of Arizona Forward, Diane Brossart, about this, and she says they think of revitalizing the canalscape as placemaking.
We are looking at the whole idea of canalscape as a regional initiative because we have more canals in the valley than Venice and Amsterdam combined. And traditionally, we've turned our back to the canals and treated them like alleyways. And so this idea embraces the canals as placemakers and gathering spaces and for recreation and activity and connecting cities and people.
And she says the project may take a long time to put into place, but it could be an iconic landmark for the valley to attract people and businesses and even commuters throughout the city.
So what is this expected to look like?
So I went for a little walk along the canal with Carrie Wilcoxon from the city of Phoenix. We started near the original area across the street from Central High School on 7th Street, and he showed me what it's going to look like in the near future.
Right now we're walking along compressed dirt. This will all be shaved back, and they're going to be putting in a 10 to 12 foot wide pathway. And at various points along the canal, especially in this area, we'll connect to neighborhood streets.
So this is really going to kind of revolutionize this place. Is that the idea?
That's the idea. We're hoping that it revolutionizes not only the place, this particular canal, but how we think about the canals and the spaces that they represent. And we think this project will really highlight that.
Tell me a little bit about some of the issues the city encountered when you're sort of redoing this and kind of attempting a whole new project.
Sure. Well, this is the Grand Canal. It's one of the older canals in town. And as a result, a lot of the city has built up around it. And even though there are standards on how you build canals and how much room you need, how much space you need, a lot of that wasn't as necessarily well adhered to or maybe didn't even exist when the city was growing. So some of the probably the most daunting problems have been where the canals cross the streets. We try and space our traffic signals every half mile or so, and a lot of our crossing points are 300-400 feet away from an existing signal. We have problems with a lot of the vertical clearance, which means that a lot of the lights that we're going to be putting up we have to be creative about how we light the canal trail.
So tell me, when this is kind of finished and done and people start to use it, what do you want people to get out of this?
Well, what I want, a couple of things. First of all, I want more people to be using things other than cars. I'm really hoping that more businesses see the people on Lunch Trail as an opportunity. And then I'm also hoping that the neighborhoods begin seeing the canals as more of an asset rather than a liability. We're expecting crime to drop. We're expecting the canals to physically look better. And we're expecting people to sort of start opening up their yards and opening up their places of business to the canal possibilities.
And Wilcoxon told me because of all of these unanticipated challenges they encountered in planning this, the cost of the project is now up to $22 million. It's being funded by the city, Salt River Project, and a $10 million grant from the federal government.
And as a kid who grew up near the canal, I'm glad to hear it's finally getting off the ground. And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Steve.
About half of all packaged goods in supermarkets today have one ingredient in common.
palm oil. That's because palm oil is highly versatile and edible. Also, it's cheap and grows easily. You just need land. But at what cost? The BBC's Manuela Zaragoza reports.
That's William Allure from Colombia. He was in London a few weeks ago, telling journalists about the bodies he's come across on the land that used to be his old farm. The last body he recovered was his mother's. Today, he says, I see all these consumer products which they call sustainable. But what do they mean by sustainable? William was forced from his home in rural Colombia. Nowadays, he campaigns to retrieve family lands and community territories lost to Colombia's growing palm oil business. It's well known that palm oil producers have been accused of clearing forest in main producer countries like Indonesia and Malaysia to make way for plantations. But William travelled to London with the pressure group the Forest People's Programme to highlight the fact that the industry is now also being accused of human rights abuses.
Los paramilitares me sacaron de la finca.
The paramilitaries came. They pulled me out of my house. They made me leave my land. Then in 2012, we went back to recover our land, and the paramilitaries had taken it over, and they said it was for a big palm oil investment. And now we can see that a big company has taken it over.
And there's no point going through the courts to try and get it back.
Lo hemos hecho.
We tried to do that, but they just don't listen. The paramilitaries' leaders detained me, and the company's lawyer made me sign documents saying we could not take them to court. They said this was a huge investment, and that if we didn't comply, the same thing would happen to us as happened to our mother and father.
The global industry body for palm oil was set up in 2004. Its job is to certify palm oil that adheres to certain sustainability standards. Currently, just over 20% of all palm oil produced around the world holds this certification. So some 80% of the world's palm oil is coming from who knows where under who knows what conditions. The RSPO now has 2,800 members. But what do they mean by sustainable? The RSPO's own literature says it means not planting on conservation land and maintaining biodiversity. It also says that its principles include responsible consideration of employees and of individuals and communities affected by growers and mills. But who checks that? Danielle Morley is its London-based European Director of Outreach and Engagement.
We have a system of third-party auditing. So traceability happens, first of all, at the plantation and the mill, and a third-party auditor will come and assess whether or not that estate and that mill are in compliance with our criteria.
And how often does that auditing happen?
A very comprehensive assessment takes place every 5 years, and then there's an annual surveillance audit. When there is evidence of wrongdoing, then there's a means of recourse and we're alerted to it. We can investigate it as well.
And that's happened at the moment with one of your biggest members, which is the Malaysian company IOI. It's had its certification revoked for all its plantations. It's a bit of a test, isn't it? Because it's a big player. It's a bit of a test for your organisation to really stick to its guns on this one.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've worked with the parties over the years to try and resolve the complaint, and ultimately the complaints panel decided that they had to put in place a sanction of revoking the certification of that particular company.
IOI is now challenging the RSPO's decision through a Swiss court. The Malaysian company says it has taken, in its words, corrective actions to review and enhance its sustainability practices. In the meantime, Unilever, also a founder of the RSPO and one of the world's largest end users of palm oil, has cancelled its contracts with IOI. But what about those land grabs?
Yeah, it's not easy. And often these cases, they may be quite protracted. They may involve land rights disputes. There may be lack of documentary evidence, for example, to support the case of local communities. The RSPO, we've recognised the fact that the complaints procedure needs to be improved, and we're currently reviewing the complaints procedure, and there's a public consultation ongoing at the moment.
Many of the big consumer goods and food companies readily admit that more needs to be done. Back at the Forest People's Programme's press conference in London, Indonesian delegate Agus Sutomo had this message for consumers.
40% of the palm oil goes to Europe, and this consumption comes from damaged soil. It seems that government, the RSPO and our own allies are not putting enough pressure on the people who are causing these problems.
That's the BBC's Manuela Zaragoza. In KJZZ News, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided a Valley man convicted of robbery and murder will get another chance to avoid the death penalty. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the case stems from a 15-year-old murder in Scottsdale.
Six of the eight high court justices ruled it was a mistake for a Maricopa County Superior Court judge to not properly inform jurors a life sentence was an option over the death penalty in the sentencing of Sean Patrick Lynch. Lynch was convicted in the 2001 slaying of James Panzarella. During sentencing, the presiding judge refused to let Lynch's defense counsel tell the jury a life sentence without parole was an alternative to death. In the Supreme Court opinion, the majority of justices felt it was a violation of Lynch's due process. Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented, with Thomas saying it was, quote, the sheer depravity of the crime that caused jurors to sentence Lynch to death. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Arizona is facing its first major measles outbreak since early last year. This most recent outbreak originated at a federal detention facility in Eloy. 11 cases have been confirmed so far, all of which are either detainees or staff at the detention center. Dr. Kara Christ with the Arizona Department of Health Services says she expects that number to keep growing.
What we're noticing is that those that did have exposure with the community, we've had extensive community exposure. So it's really going to be, what is this next generation of cases going to look like?
Chris says as the virus expands into the community, those at the greatest risk of being infected are children, the elderly, and those with suppressed immune systems. The Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity this year celebrated Endangered Species Day by highlighting 10 places saved by endangered species in them. These areas include Arizona's San Bernardino Wildlife Refuge, Lake Erie, and the Pacific Kelp Forest. Randy Seraglio is Southwest Conservation Advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity. And Randy, what did your report find about the role of the Endangered Species Act beyond the actual species being protected? It seems like there may be a slightly broader reach.
Yes, it's true. The Endangered Species Act is really one of the most successful environmental laws that we've ever passed in the United States. And the benefits of this law go way beyond just the individual species that it was designed to protect. And in fact, in the opening paragraphs of the law, it makes it very clear that the law is intended to provide a means whereby the ecosystems upon which endangered and threatened species depend might be conserved. And that benefits thousands of species, and it also benefits humans, of course.
How can you tell that protecting a particular species is also protecting an ecosystem or protecting anything else?
Well, you know, species take decades and sometimes centuries to fall into the kind of peril that lands them on the endangered species list. And it can often take that long or longer for them to get out of that trouble. And as that plays out, you can see the effects on the ground of recovery, not just of that species, but the ecosystems in which they live. So you can see cleaner water. You can see restoration being done, restoration of native plants and removal of invasive species. Same goes for waterways and oceans, you know, and also limiting the kind of damage that's being done that caused that species to come to the brink of extinction in the first place.
Is it difficult to separate out the effect on the ecosystem of a particular species versus any number of other factors that could also be taking place there?
You know, it's not very difficult because a lot of these things are sort of a very straightforward quid pro quo. I mean, if you stop unsustainable logging, the effects are going to be felt right away in terms of, you know, stopping the decline in the habitat, which is, you know, one of the key reasons why species go extinct. Or, you know, you could say that the pollution, the toxics and contamination, those sorts of things that result from extractive resource industry would be stopped and therefore almost immediately you'd start having cleaner water and a better ecosystem.
So in those examples, do you think that there would be no incentive to, for example, stop logging or stop polluting a waterway absent the presence of an endangered species that required whoever was doing those things to stop doing it?
Well, I would say that, you know, in our political system, it might be difficult to do that, but certainly there's a tremendous amount of logic for managing these kinds of industries sustainably, and that means good regulation. That means balancing the desire for the companies that do this work to make a profit with the public interest.
You mentioned that the Endangered Species Act is probably the most successful environmental law ever passed, and yet it's still somewhat controversial when new species are considered to be listed. There's often a lot of outcry about that. How do you reconcile sort of that concern about new species being listed and the effect on business and other kinds of enterprises of existing species that are listed with some of the benefits that you're talking about in this report?
Well, there's a great deal of analysis that goes into these listings. There's scientific analysis of the status of the species. There's economic analysis of what the effects of listing that species would be or designating critical habitat to protect it and those sorts of things. So there's a lot of good science that underpins the law, and I would argue that's one of the reasons why it works so well. Now, you know, when you're looking at ecosystems in the past, it was this mysterious thing. We had difficulty quantifying what the economic benefits were of intact ecosystems. Now we do a much better job of that. And we often see that the economic benefits of maintaining these ecosystems far outweigh the often short-term, narrow benefits of destroying them.
Randy Seraglio is Southwest Conservation Advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity, which has put out a report highlighting 10 areas saved by the presence of endangered species. For another perspective, we turn to Audrey Mayer, an Associate Professor of Ecology and Environmental Policy at Michigan Technological University. And Audrey, you've had a chance to look at the Center for Biological Diversity report. What do you make of it?
It's interesting. I like the way how this institute takes what might otherwise seem like inconsequential species and talks about their purpose as an umbrella for saving important places or saving beautiful places. So since you're in Arizona, I see that they have the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge listed as one of the 10 great places. And there, the endangered species are these small fish species that, you know, people might not realize or even know exist, but they're in this pretty incredible place, and using their presence to try to preserve this place, it's a good point.
So you don't think it's too much of a leap, for example, to say that by protecting an endangered species, you're really doing more than just protecting that particular species?
No, definitely not. And in fact, if you go to the Endangered Species Act, the intent was to save the species and their habitat and, you know, everything that depends upon that species. And so the intent of Congress was that these species places would be protected, not just the species themselves.
Is this something that you think people generally understand about the Endangered Species Act? Because it is a fairly controversial law, and when new species are considered to be listed, there's often a lot of outcry and controversy about that.
Definitely. I know that there's a lot of worry that a listing will detract from economic productivity. So, like the spotted owl, the northern spotted owl, basically halted logging in the Pacific Northwest when it was listed. And so I can see how people get the notion that saving an endangered species means that a lot of people lose their jobs or they're no longer able to do anything on their property. But there's a lot of, particularly now, there's more policies that are wrapped within the Endangered Species Act or programs that can alleviate some of those economic impacts so that species can be protected without this massive detriment to local economies.
It seems like in general, a lot of these discussions come down to who's more important, people and their needs or animals in the environment and their needs. Is there a way, do you think, to do both?
Yeah, and there's a lot of researchers that are trying to quantify the value of ecosystems and species to try to help people and policymakers understand the value that ecological diversity and processes have for people. So ecosystems do a lot of stuff for us, like flood protection and climate change mitigation, that would be really expensive if we had to do it ourselves. So trying to help people understand the value that they get, either bringing that into a marketplace or otherwise trying to express what these environmental systems do for us, I think is a way for people to understand the value of these species in these places, and then for them to be able to bring that into the total decision making and say, okay, here's the value we get from the dam, here's the value we get from all the species and the ecosystems that'll be lost due to the dam, and make a more holistic decision.
Audrey Mayer is an associate professor of ecology and environmental policy at Michigan Technological University. It's kind of like the holy grail of medicine, not just a cure for cancer, but a vaccine to stop people from getting it in the first place. And not just for one or even a few types of cancer, but all of them. That's exactly what Stefan Albert Johnston's working on. He's the director of the Center for Innovations in Medicine in the Biodesign Institute at ASU and has done a safety trial for his universal cancer vaccine in dogs. He's now working on getting a trial set up to see if it'd work under ideal circumstances. Johnston joins me. And Stefan, what exactly have you been doing?
So I'm an inventor. And so for the last 10 years, I've been working on a potential invention of a universal preventative cancer vaccine. So this is something you take ahead of time before you get it. So we've tried to figure out whether that's possible by looking in a lot of different cancers and seeing if we could find the components we would put in such a vaccine and then show that it was safe.
For a lot of people, I think when they imagine vaccines, they think of the flu vaccine, something that a lot of people get every year that has three strains, which researchers think might be the ones that match up to the most common ones in a given year. How do you get all the different kinds of cancer that exists in the world into one vaccine?
That's a good question. And most people think you can't because they've sequenced a lot of tumors and they think that they're all personal. That's not exactly true. They were looking at the wrong place. So we just screened a lot of, started with breast cancer, just screened a lot of breast cancers. Then we screened a lot of pancreatic and lung till we found enough mistakes that all of them were making in common that we could pool them all together to make a common vaccine.
When we talk about mistakes, are you talking cellular mistakes?
Yeah. So tumors, in order to get ahead of the immune system, they have to make a lot of mistakes in order to evolve. And that's their Achilles heel. So we just looked for those mistakes that they're making more frequently and put those into the vaccine.
Obviously, when somebody takes a vaccine, there's no guarantee that that is going to prevent the illness for which you're being vaccinated against. I would imagine that the same would be true for cancer, that this vaccine would not be seen as a quote-unquote cure for cancer.
Yes, that's true. Most vaccines work at fairly high efficiencies. They have to work at about 80% efficiency in order to get herd immunity. There is no such thing as a herd immunity for cancer, so it's different than that. But even a cancer vaccine that was 50% effective would have a tremendous impact on the health of the nation and the world.
You're looking at mistakes that cells and tumors are interacting with in the body. What is different about where you are looking than all the other people who are trying to do basically the same thing are looking?
Yes, that's a good question, too, and I often get asked that. Everybody else, almost everybody else, has been looking at the DNA, the part that's inherited in every tumor. And what they find at that level is that every tumor looks different than each other. But there's other levels of transmission of information in a cell. And one of the levels is where they make a large piece of RNA that has to be spliced up. And that's a very inefficient process. And cancers make a lot more mistakes at doing that than normal cells do. But almost nobody in the cancer field were looking for those mistakes. We literally found those pieces of mistakes that we used in the trash bin of the people that were sequencing tumors.
Why do you think that nobody else thought to look there?
Partly because they weren't trying to make a vaccine. Almost the whole community is focused on making new drugs. Until recently, it was all that sequencing was focused on finding a new drug target. For
treatments.
Yes, treatments. You're going to get the tumor, we're going to find the tumor, we're going to biopsy your tumor, and then we'll give you the right drug. Only recently have people started to think about using the immune system against the tumors, and it looks very promising. But what they're doing there is they're going to sequence it again at the DNA, but they're going to sequence it for your particular vaccine. So everybody will get their own individual vaccine after they have the tumor.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it seems like a lot of medicine is going very much toward individualized medicine, treating your specific DNA, your specific body. It sounds like you're saying for cancer, we might not need to actually do that.
Yeah, not only we might not need to do it, but I think we really can't do it that way for the whole world.
Assuming that everything goes well with the trial, the efficacy trial you're doing with the dogs, what would be the earliest that you think you could have a vaccine for cancer that people could use?
In people. I think the earliest we could get a safety trial would probably be in 2 to 3 years. And then that we'd have to do the efficacy trial. And that's a very controversial thing. There's some scenarios where we could do an efficacy trial and we could answer the question pretty quickly, and you're talking maybe 5 years or so. It might be proven in people. Other people have scenarios where it'll take 10 or 20 years to actually figure that out.
Well, I mean, what do you think? What's your gut feeling?
I think if people get imaginative enough and there's enough drive, if your dogs aren't getting cancer, I think there might be enough drive to do a large clinical trial that would show this efficacious in 5 years or so.
Stefan Albert Johnston is co-director of the Center for Innovations in Medicine at ASU. Stefan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark.
At the heart of many adventure stories is the hunt for buried treasure.
More clues. What a surprise.
The clues lead to an ancient tomb or a cave or a wrecked ship.
One-Eyed Willie. Yeah, he was the most famous pirate in his time.
And sometimes the treasure's not even worth stealing because it's cursed or it's guarded by a giant dragon.
Where are you?
That's all fantasy, but the thrill of the hunt is very real. That's why so many people have searched for a treasure chest rumored to be buried in the Rocky Mountains. And a new documentary explores their adventure stories. The show's Annika Klein maps it out for us.
Time to hit the road.
We're gonna go find some treasure? Are you sure we're going the right way?
The film is called Fenn's Searchers, and it documents the journey of a few people who are searching for the treasure of a man named Forrest Fenn. Now, Forrest Fenn is not an outlaw or a prospector from the Wild West. He's still alive. Here he is speaking in the film's trailer about why he buried a treasure valued at least $1 million.
My motivation was to get the kids away from their texting machines, out of the game room, off of the couch. I want them to smell the sunshine.
He's a lifelong adventurer himself.
That's documentary creator Matt Maizano.
Because Forrest was an amateur archaeologist, over the years, he'd gathered up many very interesting historical artifacts and valuable gold and amulets and necklaces and things like that.
Then, Fenn says, he put it all into a chest and buried it somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. No treasure map, but he did give clues in the form of a poem.
Begin it where warm waters halt and take it in the canyon down. Not far, but too far to walk.
That was Fenn reading part of that cryptic poem on CBS Sunday Morning. The story was picked up by other major news outlets, too, and that's when Maizano found out about it, and it blew him away.
The way we live with modern technology and GPS and, you know, all kinds of technology that's making the wilderness much less unknown. Here you have this treasure hunt that this guy's created in 2010, and now we're in 2016. I mean, this does not happen.
Maizano and his wife started tagging along with a couple of these searchers last year, and he says there are thousands of them out there. They chat in online forums, they dig from Montana down to New Mexico, and they each have a story about why.
And you've got people at all levels of involvement, from just casually looking online once in a while, to people that go out and search for the treasure once a week, overnight, 9-hour hikes to these really treacherous, deep forest locations.
These searchers became the focus of Maizano's film. There's a woman who has searched 60 times around the same hill, and a man who joined up because he loves geocaching.
When I find the chest, and I will find the chest, I'm going to take a selfie.
Some of the searchers meet for an annual camping trip just north of Santa Fe. The next one is coming up this Saturday. Maizano will screen a rough version of his film there, and of course there will be digging for treasure. But Maizano will be digging for something else.
We're going out there to kind of find an ending for the film.
But he says the ending doesn't have to be lifting the wooden lid to a trove of gleaming gold. It's the journey that matters to him. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
And you can find the trailer for the film Fenn's Searchers and also the poem of clues on our website, kjzz.org. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.